Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I have a friend who just went through the prostate cancer thing, and he gave me a pretty good idea of what it was like. But I got a really good idea after reading Thomas Kennedy's award-winning essay, I Am Joe's Prostate. Here are a couple of lines. The wand seems to have been plunged into the very pit of your soul where it is being stirred around. You groan, but it elicits no attention or relief. Later on this hour, a new documentary from Terrence O'Malley, Tom and Harry, The Boss and the President. The director and author produced Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time, and another on the Union Station Massacre. But first up, writer Thomas Kennedy. One of his recent novels is Falling Sideways, about corporate life. He teaches at Farley Dickinson University, and his piece, I Am Joe's Prostate, won a National Magazine Award and caused legions of readers, including myself, to squirm and twist and practically beg for mercy in the midst of reading that piece. Thomas, nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Well, here you are. You have all these tests. Your PSA level was high. So you went through all this stuff, and the result was what, Thomas?
Well, they took various tests, you know, about 30 biopsies.
And took various pieces from the way deep inside of you.
Yeah. Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And finally, the doctor said to me, you know, you definitely have cancer.
Yeah.
And it probably has spread, but we can't find a cancer cell.
They couldn't figure out where it was.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
So they went in again, yeah.
They went in again, and surgically this time, and I was put to sleep, and I woke up.
Mercifully, yeah.
Yes, and the doctor came in, and he said, well, I saw a very nice-looking prostate.
Guess what, buddy? All of that for nothing. Yeah.
Exactly.
What went through your mind at that point after all of those tests and all of those people probing and examining and searching? What did you make of that?
Well, I didn't really believe that I had cancer. Hmm. And they were trying to convince me. And, you know, the doctor said to me, you know, I think I was 62 or 63 years old at the time. And he said, you know, there's no reason for you not to live another 20 years. And, you know, he sort of convinced me.
Yeah, and he's saying all that to you, and he's telling you, I know it's in there.
Yes.
We're going to find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they didn't find it.
And your PSA level then was super high. Why?
They don't know, and they're still studying it. I go in every 6 months now, mm-hmm. and have a PSA blood test, and it's still elevated, and it's higher than it was at the time of the cancer scare too. And I know, you know, they called me in for a consultation when I get back to Copenhagen,
mm-hmm.
And I know that they're going to try to convince me to have another biopsy, but I will not.
Then they're done that.
Yes.
Well, and the difficult thing about your piece is anyone who reads it is going to hesitate big time before going through the experience you had. Any concern about that in your own mind?
You know, I didn't actually think of that. I just wanted to exercise myself from the whole experience. And, you know, I found it becoming sort of humorous, you know, sort of funny.
It was kind of funny.
And, you know, that plan to commit suicide, you know, I really loved that. Mm-hmm. I loved writing that, you know.
Yeah. You really got a sense reading this thing that you felt like the proverbial piece of meat on the grill and not a whole lot more than that, the way you were treated almost from the first moment.
Well, you know, that was over a couple of years and over two hospitals. The first hospital, they did treat me like a piece of meat on the grill.
Mm-hmm.
But the second hospital treated me very well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but they were wrong.
Right from the start.
Yes. Yeah.
And you did feel you wanted to write about it because why?
Well, I write about everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. That's how I deal with things. That's sort of my spiritual discipline. if it comes out funny, all the better.
Yeah. What kind of response did you get to that piece?
Quite a good response.
I was going to say.
Bob Stewart, who published it at New Letters Magazine, nominated it for a National Magazine Award, and it became a finalist and was up against Stephen King writing about Harry Potter.
No kidding.
And I thought,
you're done.
There's no way that I'm going to win. But I wanted to go to the ceremony, and by God, I won. Or New Letters won, you know.
And you were surprised by that, obviously.
Yes, absolutely.
And you think you won. Why? Obviously, it's a tremendously well-written piece, but clearly you struck a chord probably with so many of the judges who were reading this piece.
Well, you know, I think I was up against some really good writers and really good magazines, and I felt that we were the token literary magazine. But actually, if you read the essays, the four or five essays that were finalists, and by excellent writers, they were, you know, not that good.
Yeah.
And so I think I lucked out in that way too, you know.
You said you found the whole thing humorous, and you describe it that way, and looking back at some of these events and some of the people you talked to, Thomas, did you see those moments in real time that way, or was it only in reflection that things became a little more comical to you?
It's difficult to say, although when they were sort of the scene that you read, when they were probing me, you know, to the pit of my very soul.
Yeah.
It was not funny. It was not funny. But, you know, when I tried to find a way to describe it, you know, I found that there was no way that I could describe the pain and humiliation of it other than, you know, being self-ironic.
Yeah. Well, I think you managed to pull it off pretty well. You had a great word for the verb urinate, which was what in this piece?
Micturate.
I'd never heard that before until I came across your story. I understood it pretty clearly what it was, but where did that come from?
I don't know. You know, someone told me to micturate in a kind of a bucket with a gauge on it. And I instinctively understood what micturate meant.
And why did they say urinate? Is there something about the word that...
I have no idea. And, you know, my Danish translator said no one would use that word. And I said, well, they used that word. No one would use that word.
But they did over and over and over again, right? Well, the word again is micturate, in case you're wondering out there. Why be a writer? I'm just wondering, in an age when it seems... You know, more and more, Thomas, that fewer and fewer people are reading great literature.
Yes. Well, I decided a long time ago that I wanted to be a writer. It was the year that Ernest Hemingway committed suicide in 1961. I was 17 years old. And my father had given me a book by Dostoevsky. And
I was going to ask you about that. Crime and Punishment, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved... You know, well, when I first looked at the book, I thought, this sounds weird, you know. But I started...
When you're 17, everything sounds weird, though, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. except rock lyrics. I started to read that, and within two pages, I thought, this is what I want to do and be. And then I read all of... Dostoevsky's and all of Steinbeck, and you know, I just kept reading like three to five books a week.
Really?
And then I decided that I read a story by Catherine Mansfield called Miss Brill, and it's a very sad story, a very short and very sad story, and it's about a lonely old woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that Catherine Mansfield was responsible for this old woman's unhappiness. And I wanted to write her a letter scolding her. I was kind of a weird kid, you know. And, you know, I looked on the book and I discovered an astonishing fact that Catherine Mansfield had been dead for 40 years. And then I looked at it completely differently, and I thought it was as though she had reached out of the grave and touched deep into my heart. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to do that.
What was it about you? What was it about literature that was able to penetrate you as effectively as it did, Thomas? What was it?
Well, I think it was that I had never consciously looked into my mind before. I had never tried to hear myself thinking. And I suddenly realized that I was seeing, you know, what in reading novels, I was seeing into fictional characters' minds. And they were pretty similar to mine, you know. I mean, even Raskolnikov, I mean, I didn't want to kill anybody. But, you know.
In Crime and Punishment.
In Crime and Punishment. Yeah. You know, his thoughts were similar, you know, many of them were similar to mine. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe it's okay to look into my head. And maybe, you know, I'm not, you know, completely crazy or yeah. whatever, you know, because you have so many thoughts in your head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you still teach. I mean, do you think kids these days, and I've taught a little bit too, are they reading Crime and Punishment? Do you have a sense that those connections are still getting made?
Well, Crime and Punishment is probably still read. There are a lot of other books that are not read. Aldous Huxley, for example. I was on an Aldous Huxley kick. Probably The Doors of Perception are still read, you know, by people who like marijuana.
Yeah,
but his novels, I don't think they're read. But you know, they have new writers that they read, and you know, I mean, literature is maybe not as central as it was, but it's. I think there are more books being published now than previously.
It's like people say newspapers are in trouble, you know, where I also work, and yet you look online, there's a whole lot of information out about Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, and more than you could ever get through ever, I think, sometimes,
yes.
you know. So and why is that, do you think? Where's it coming from?
You mean the
outpouring of writing, if you wonder if people are still reading as much?
Well, I guess that, you know, people suddenly have the opportunity to have their voices heard, you know, by, you know, hundreds or even thousands or even millions of people. And, you know, you can put yourself up on YouTube and count the hits.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't get that many hits, though.
Yeah. I mean, does it make it harder to sort of get noticed and get attention from the literary world when you're competing against so much stuff?
Well, you know, I sort of decided quite a few years ago that I was a small press writer. And
you're okay with that?
And I was content to be. It was only when I won this National Magazine Award, and this is in 2008,
mm-hmm.
so that's how many
years ago? Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years since I started to want to be a writer? And because of that attention, I got an agent, and he sold four books that I had published previously in Ireland. In a small press way, and he sold them to Bloomsbury worldwide. And so I just, I mean, I was content to be a small press writer. Now I'm kind of a large press writer, but, you know, there's not that many copies of the books out there. 20,000
yeah.
of each or something like that.
The writer Thomas Kennedy is our guest this half hour. He speaks on Monday evening tonight at 7 at the UMKC Miller Nichols Library. That's at 800 East 51st Street. The admission is free. That's tonight at 7 at UMKC's Miller Nichols Library. I was struck just 2 years after your father handed you a copy of Crime and Punishment. You already had determined you wanted to be a writer. By age 21, you've dropped out of college, Thomas, and you're riding buses and hitchhiking across the country, living in different cities for the next 16 years. How did you survive during those years, and were you writing the entire time?
I survived barely.
Yeah.
I did temporary jobs and part-time jobs, and at one point in San Francisco, I was writing letters for people for a dollar a piece.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How'd you get that gig?
Well, I was talking to a waitress one day, and she said, you know, I told her that I wanted to be a writer, and she said, "Oh, you're good with language." And I said, "Well, you know,
I'm trying."
And yes, exactly.
We're all trying.
And I had had rented a typewriter, an old Underwood, for $5 a month. And she said, "Well, you know, my son was drafted, and he's not 21 yet. So I think that you know, the government drafted him illegally because he can't sign for himself. And I want to write letters to my senator and to my congressman." And she said, I'll pay you a dollar a letter. And so I started writing letters for her. And, you know, a dollar was a lot of money back then. You know, I could live for 3 days on a dollar, you know.
Suddenly you're a professional writer.
Yes.
By writing letters. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, then in 71, you returned to college. You graduated in 74. What brought about the end to all the traveling you were doing?
Well, I got a job. I was working for the World Medical Association at that time, and they offered me a job in France. And I took it, and I had already decided that I wanted to live in Denmark because they had sent me to Denmark 2 years before, and I loved it, just fell in love with it.
What about it that you loved?
Well, I liked the light. I liked the architecture. I liked the people. I liked the beer very much. Yeah. There's 150 different kinds of beer served in 1,525 serving houses in Copenhagen.
And how many of those have you already visited during your years there?
Well, only a small percentage.
Well, that's too bad. I thought you were going to say at least 1,000.
I'm still trying.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote one book, which is a novel disguised as a guide to the bars of Copenhagen. And there I have 59 of them. And the research was delightful. But not tax deductible.
Yeah. So you just liked it there.
I love it there.
Yeah.
And, you know, working for the World Medical Association and then the European Medical Association and then the Danish Medical Association,
yeah,
I was traveling a lot. So, and, you know, on a different scale sort of than my hitchhiking days. And, you know, I sort of liked, you know, staying in a hotel.
And you kept writing the whole time, right?
Yes.
And what kept you writing, even though you weren't having a whole lot of success?
Well, I just really wanted to write. And, you know, I tried to quit, actually. And
Quit writing?
I tried to quit writing. And as a symbol of my quitting, I sold all my fiction books to a secondhand shop in Copenhagen. And then I started to miss them, like old friends. And I started to buy them back at, you know, like 10 times the price that I'd gotten for
funny.
Them. You know,
so. Yeah.
And then shortly after that, you know, I realized that I could not quit. And shortly after that, I started to have success. I started to publish and you know, it was 20 years without publishing anything.
And although, what a great feeling that must have been.
Oh, it was. I was delighted. You know, for my first published story, I received $20, and that's for 20 years of work. As Bob Dylan would say, dollar a year it's worth.
I come from a family of writers, father and a brother, and I have just incredible appreciation and respect for folks who can put together a book. I just think that's an amazing thing. Absolutely an amazing accomplishment.
Well, that's all I wanted to do with my life. And when it seemed that I was failing, I was in danger of becoming a bitter fellow. But then, you know, it started to turn around. A poet, Rilke, the Austrian poet, he said that a tree in winter looks dead, but it's only working up the force to bloom in spring. And I sort of felt like I had a 20-year winter.
There's a moral in here somewhere, I gather, for folks who are listening, right?
I think if you can't quit, then you know that, and you keep trying.
You know, among your many works now is your Copenhagen Quartet, four novels set in that city, each written in a different style, all pay homage to the streets, landmarks, and establishments of your adopted city. The first one was published in 2002, the final one in 2005, four novels in 3 years. That's a lot of writing in a relatively short time. What was your writing routine like during those years that you were able to turn out four in just 3 years, Thomas?
Well, actually, I had written the books over a longer time span. Yeah. They were published quickly. They were published one a year for 4 years. The second one was already written in 1996. I just, you know, didn't know what to do with it. And I suddenly realized, then I started writing this novel disguised as a guide to the bars of Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of information about Copenhagen and so on and so forth. And I started writing that in 1999. And I think I finished it in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 3 years on one book. But actually, the other two books I wrote in 1 year apiece. And I think that they're my best two books.
How did you pull that off?
I don't know. You know, I just felt, you know, I felt like I was having success. My mother used to say, nothing succeeds like success. I felt like, you know, this. I had this four-book contract from this Irish publisher, and he was very enthusiastic about the books. And, you know, it just came pouring out.
You know, one of those books is Falling Sideways. It's about corporate life. What are you trying to say in that novel about corporate life?
Well, it's about a downsizing firm, and what I was trying to say was that, you know, you don't really know what you do for corporate life, in corporate life. Maybe some people do, but I worked 28 years as an executive, and I did not really know what I did. You know, I traveled a lot, and I met people, and I introduced people to other people. And I sent emails, and I received emails, and, you know, and I would, so every so often I would ask myself, what am I doing? You know, what am I actually producing? But they seemed to be pleased with me, and, you know, I had lots of free time to write, and so whatever I was doing, they seemed to value.
Yeah, I wonder what it is about, you know, getting more years in life. I just celebrated a birthday, so you go through these reflective things. But I do, you know, you sit back, and in my case, I'm a journalist, and you look back, and you've written hundreds and then thousands of articles. And sometimes you do sit back and wonder, well, is anybody reading, anybody noticing? I've sat and written these things, and, you know, some get a little bit of feedback, some don't. And you do wonder sometimes, what am I doing?
Yeah. Well, there is a literary community, particularly in the United States, a small press literary community and university literary community. And it's really a national treasure. I mean, this does not exist in other countries. So, you know, I felt like a member of that community. And, you know, that helped me overcome the kind of doubts. And, you know, of course, you know, when I turned 50, you know, I sort of still had plenty of ambition. When I turned 60, I still had plenty of ambition. Now I'll soon turn 70 in a couple of years. And, well, I still feel ambition, you know.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Well, I sure enjoyed having you, Thomas. I should point out Thomas Kennedy again. He speaks this evening at 7 at the Miller's Nickel Library on the UMKC campus. That's at 7 o'clock, 800 East 51st Street. The admission is free, and thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you very much, Steve.
I sure enjoyed having you, Thomas. You bet. That's Thomas Kennedy. Coming up in our second half, filmmaker Terrence O'Malley about his new film, Tom and Harry, The Boss and the President. That's Tom Pendergast and a guy named Harry Truman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.